Access number 30631, Mr. Herbert Landberg, Reel 8. Now, any other incidents on your way through Germany? I mean, how did you get on with the Germans generally? The civilians that you encountered in your work?
Well, the strange thing is that after Hitler, after Hitler's death was announced, you would have thought the whole of Germany would collapse. But it didn't. It's been one of the puzzles to my mind, and I read it in papers too, that Germans were still believing in, had the Nazis won this war, it would have made it a better Europe under National Socialist or Nazi ideology governing the Herrenvolk, the master race, and the rest of the people just doing what they're told. And whereas in France, everything collapsed when Pétain went to Vichy, when France was separated into Vichy France, which was under German supervision but not occupation in Germany. Remained National Socialist.
So it wasn't just Hitler; it was the country.
I couldn't believe that my father had been fighting for this country, which he called his fatherland, in the 1914-18 war, and that was the same country now, which had turned absolutely. Not inhuman, but had turned completely away from civilized behavior.
Now, any more incidents on your way through Germany that just give us an idea of what life, of what you were experiencing?
Oh, yes, when I was billeted in Hamburg at one time.
Now, hang on, is that after the end of the war?
It was towards the end of the war, yes.
Well, anything else before you got to Hamburg?
Yes, when we got into Hamburg.
What happened when you got to Hamburg? Because, do you remember the capture of Hamburg?
Well, the RAF had sort of silenced the heavy guns, and when the bulk of the British Army moved into Hamburg, it was just a question of mopping up the odd SS headquarters. And
were you involved in any of that?
Yes, we were involved.
Tell me about that.
Well, the one of the headquarters was in a bunker, and when they were told to come out, they had no chance of. They were told by us on instructions from the commanding officer of the fighting forces behind us to tell them that they had no chance whatsoever. They might just well come out with their hands up. They did come out, but one of them had something in his fist, and we asked him to open his fist, and he threw a Mills bomb or a type of Mills bomb at us, and was sure. A miracle, none of us were injured or killed, and so after that we killed a lot as they came out. There was no question about it, to show mercy, because this could have happened. Every other man had something hidden somewhere, either before, like the modern suicide bombers on their body, or, as in this case, hidden in a fist, and used clearly, of course, without any hope of getting away with it, but at least taking some of us with them.
And anything else about the capture? What was happening? I mean, so you captured you kept this SS bunker. What was it like down there? Did you go inside it?
Well, they had food for weeks, and even heating arranged, air conditioning, and it was had been used evidently for quite a while. We thought it was just used during the final hours of the war, but evidently it was a head office for several years.
It was a headquarters bunker.
Yes.
And anything else? Was that? Did you do any other SS bunkers, or was that just the only one?
Oh no, we found quite a few. Not so much in bunkers, but in camouflaged places, or in farmhouses, or former farmhouses. And when we went inside, the German staff, the SS, had fled. But they had to clearly be used as place of central organization for
the
What
about
defense.
The Hamburg radio and newspapers? Did
oh,
you,
yes, we were told to look for what was called Lord Ho-Ho. And he got his name because he always announced dreadful things happening to the British, either in the European theater of war, or even as far away as Hong Kong and in other places. And he, at the end of each of these dreadful things, which a battleship sunk and so on, he used to laugh, ho, 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 ho. And that's how he got his name, Lord Ho. His name was William Joyce.
Now, did you go to Hamburg Radio? Because there was a building, wasn't
there? Oh, yes. We went through there. He had fled. And eventually he was cornered. And his defense was he was not English. He was Irish. And when he went to the Nuremberg courts, you know, that was his main defense. He didn't say any more much. And it was not accepted, and he was sentenced to death, and I think he was hanged. He wanted to be shot for a firing squad, but it was turned down, and he was.
Now, what state was Hamburg in? How badly battered was it?
Oh, the strange thing is that the RAF had bombed Hamburg several times, but not so much the civilian quarters, but what we thought, or what they thought, were the defenses, especially the naval side of it. U-boat had a U-boat port of, not so much in an emergency, but a regular U-boat supply place, and most of the docks had been flattened. I mean, the RAF had done a very solid job. But I knew Hamburg as a boy, and I went to the Jones Allee, as I remember, and the house where I used to live was stood still there. Of course, different tenants had. My uncle and aunt had left Germany. They were very lucky and lived in Golders Green for most of the war.
Now, there's a story here about you were. You were interviewing generals.
That was later. Then
okay,
we, then
all right. We so what happened? Tell me some more about what happened in Hamburg then.
Yes, we were asked then to report to the Lüneburg Heath, and if we knew.
Hang on. Anything else in Hamburg before that?
Before that.
Were you in Hamburg when the VE Day came?
When what?
VE Day, the end of the war in Europe.
Oh, no, we were certainly on our way. From Hamburg back into main part, as it was far north of Germany, and main part, and to look to make our way slowly to the Lüneburg Heath.
So you were already on your way to Lüneburg Heath. Were there any special celebrations on VE Day for you?
Oh yes, one large group went to of the fighting forces were asked to report to Paris and for a special ceremony at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And I was one of them. I was taken away.
Now, that's not VE Day, though, is it?
No, that was not. But
what about actual VE Day?
Yes, okay. I think we were on our way. We did not. But there was celebration of the troops were, of course, all given special rations and things like that. And at the same time, there was a lack of alcohol. It was supposed to be a lack of supply, but it was on purpose so that they didn't all get drunk. And in the street parties of soldiers, you know, everywhere celebrating.
And what did you do? You were just on your way to Lüneburg Heath, were you?
Yes, we were. I think we didn't have much time to stop anywhere.
Now tell me about why were you going to Lüneburg Heath? Were all of you going? Your whole armored car, or what was going to Lüneburg Heath? Just you?
To where?
Lüneburg Heath. Who was going? Your whole unit or what?
Oh yes, whole unit.
So what were you doing at Lüneburg Heath?
And where?
What were you doing at Lüneburg Heath?
What's the last word?
Heath.
Well, we were told, we were given a whole list of questions and with names of generals of which we had to memorize or have in front of us and write down the answers that we were getting. The main thing was to find out why the Russians were not able to get to make a much headway in the east of eastern part of the war, in one part of East Germany. And it turned out one of the generals admitted more or less, although he was not very forthcoming at first, that they were all former Hitler's bodyguard, Waffen-SS, and they would not surrender or they would fight to the last man. And if they could, if the British forces who were opposing them and who couldn't make, on the Russian Russian forces from the east, just isolate them and don't sort of force your way through that part of Russia, they could find a different way to Berlin without too much loss of life.
Now, so this means that you were VE Day wasn't on your way to Lüneburg, it was afterwards. Yeah. Okay. So, because the war was still...
Is it on again?
It is, yeah. So there's a bit of a cuff-off. You went to Lüneburg Heath before the end of the war.
Oh yeah.
Now, there's one general in particular that sort of asked you how you spoke German. So tell me that story.
One general I was interviewing, he suddenly said, Sergeant, or yes, I think he called me Sergeant, how is it you speak German so well? And I was very sorely tempted to tell him to shut up. I was asking the questions, not him. But we wanted information from him about this SS, you know, about why the Russians didn't make any progress on that part of the front. And I said, had you been serving in that part? Yes, he said, before he had been in command of a large section of that part of the country. And he can, without becoming a traitor to his own country, he could admit, if I give him some information that he wanted to know in return, that forces, German forces, opposing the Russians were Waffen-SS, and who would not surrender or would retreat they would fight to the very last man.
So this is what you were talking about before. Yeah, do you remember anything else about the interviews you carried out at that time?
We had to ask him if what he thought of Dönitz, you know, who was taken over as head of the armed forces, although he was an admiral of the fleet, and was it a good choice? He said, yes, I suppose from your point of view it was a good choice because he was not a fanatical Nazi. He was a naval officer through and through. But whether he would make a good head of armed forces in general, it was very doubtful. The army didn't think much of an admiral suddenly when being head of the armed forces, you know, the new Führer, as he was called after Hitler, title as Führer.
Anything else you were asking them, or anything else you remember about the interviews with senior Nazis?
Oh yes, we had to ask them if we allowed the officers to keep their short arms, would we get in a better cooperation for them if we respected that? He said, well, the trouble is that most of them are Nazis through and through first, and then officers, soldiers second. So I didn't think it would much good, or would have much effect. And that was relayed back to our people, and they thought that he was not speaking his mind. He was correct in his assessment of that idea, and so the officers were allowed to keep their short arms, but they had to surrender their bullets. That was official.
And what about any other? Did you just do one general or one off senior officer, or did you do several?
Yes, I can't remember the actual question. Some of the questions were very involved, military ones.
But did you do more than one officer?
Oh, yes, quite a number of them, because although there were 12 amplifier units, they were not all there in time, you know, at the time in Lüneburg Heath. So we had hands full, and in fact some of the questions which we were supposed to ask, we just didn't find time for it. But I thought the main thing was to get an idea of the numbers of regiments, not so much of men, of regiments which were deployed all around the Western front, and how to dispose of all the weapons which they had to put into a huge heap, you know, in the center of a Lüneburg Heath, whether how we can best dispose of it without any hope of ever being used again. And
so how long were you doing this interviewing at Lüneburg?
Oh, it was straightforward. Some of the officers cooperated and gave what our officers thought were genuine answers, and some were lying through their teeth, which was later found, or would force found at the time, that couldn't have been possible. It was not a very successful performance on our part. We weren't very proud of what we got out of them. Not because of inexperience with high-ranking officers, but mainly because it was quite clear that they were under an oath not to divulge anything other than under the League of Nations type of name, rank, and so on, and they were hiding behind that, some of them quite genuinely. You know, they were only supposed to give us their rank, their title, and the basic details, but not information of which would affect the surrender of how many men in that regiment and so on. We had to find that out the hard way.
So, what happened next?
The next thing, I think, from Hamburg...
Lüneburg.
Lüneburg. Yes. We were pretty busy there. I remember we were moving from tent to tent. I think we had instructions to find one or two people who would be accused of war crimes. And it was more a sort of searching for the people some of the general's description as not by name but by anything. One of them was, I forget now his name, quite a high-ranking officer, and how he could be spotted or could before arrest would be he was limping badly, and we couldn't find one who did. And in the end, it turned out he had already left and had gone to his home, where he was arrested eventually. But it was more of a sort of policing rather than anything else that we had to do, and we weren't very good at it.
Now, so what's the next thing you remember? You're working on Lüneburg for quite a while, interviewing these senior generals.
Oh yes, it took quite a few weeks, really. And the main thing was to get enough food for them through, because they were suddenly concentrated, thousands of men, in an area which was already short of rations and very strict rationing of the civilian population. And it was organizing really a food supply for the prisoners of war, which they eventually became, all of them, the men as well as the officers. And it was something that we were not really trained to do, but we were using local people as well, and who were very keen on getting their men who had been fighting after all for them to fed and watered.
So what's the next thing you remember?
I think most of us who wanted to get away from, most of us in those, we were three amplifier units, we were going around as these 12 men, and we had a little powwows from time to time to see how we can finish our work and get nearer to the coast for repatriation to the UK.
You wanted to go home. You were looking for demobilisation.
Well, mobilisation for me was in December that year.
You knew that, did you?
We knew, because we all had numbers given on based on our enlistment. You know, the lower the number, the sooner would you be demobilized. And it depended very much not on your war service, but on enlistment. So as I enlisted very early on, I was told that December would be a deadline for end of war service.
Now, so you're on Lunenburg. When was this Paris business? Because you went to Paris, you said, for the celebration there. What do you remember of that?
Oh, yes. We were told there would be a ceremony at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, or the Arc de Triomphe, and the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier was underneath. And there would be troops from the Free French Forces as well, so you would be needed to organize the position of them, and the language question came up then again, and it was a very moving ceremony.
What do you remember of it?
Oh, that. A lot of people, of course, were talking about their war experience. You know, they seemed very, very keen to talk about it. But basically, it was a very friendly and moving sort of ceremony. I thought it would be a bit of a dead loss because nobody knew each other except by chance. Forget now who spoke to us. It was not a religious ceremony. And it wasn't Montgomery who spoke. I think it was an American general who talked about cooperation and working together, and that soon there would be transport to the for demobilization to their home countries. Have another bit.
It's all right. Now, so anything else in that? So then after that, you went back to Germany. Were you still on Lunenburg Heath then?
Yes.
And what happens for the rest of the, you know, there's 3 or 4, 5 or 6 months before. What are you doing?
We were mainly organizing the billeting of the troops, you know, because it was
the troops or the prisoners.
It was getting very cold. The weather was getting very cold.
Is this the troops or the prisoners?
No, the troops.
The British troops.
British troops. Yes.
Now, how did you do that? Tell me about all getting billets sorted.
Yes. Well, we went from house to house, and if we got the impression there were only two people living in a large house, then we were able to give them a notice of you will have 3, 4, 5 or 6 men reporting here, and you will have special ration delivered, so you don't have to give up any of your own food, but put all your valuables in such a place that they're not tempting to help themselves to it. But we didn't put it as crudely as that, but I mean that basically was that we wanted to leave France, especially and Germany too, not with a bad name for doing naughty things. For instance, I found in the room that I had a very large collection of stamps. It obviously was a stamp collector. And I told them to put it in a safe place because it would be tempting for anybody who even visited to take a liking to it. And
what were people like? I mean, were they...
And then suddenly I had to see a dentist. And the army dentist was miles away, so I went to a local dentist, and he said, "Well, you need a filling," and but I haven't got any amalgam or gold. If you go around the shop, see if you can pick up a gold watch somewhere for a little money, and I'll give you a gold filling. And I went round the town and I got a gold watch from some backstreet jeweler, and I was proud of that gold filling for years after the war. And he was a very friendly type of dentist.
We were aware of the non-fraternisation rules.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, it was quite a joke in our case, because our officer commanding, you know, Sergeant Major McGibbon, he enforced it very strictly, and he was very critical of so many people not observing it. And then later on, we suddenly found he had been, messing about is the wrong word, but associating with a German girl for quite a while, even during the fighting period. And at the end of the war, he married her, divorced his English wife, whom we know, I know, because I lived around here, strange enough, in the Wimbledon Chase. And had two very nice sons, and he married her, and he died quite happily, I think last year, and we still were in touch with his German wife.
So it wasn't terribly serious for you lot?
No, he was a proper hypocrite.